Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with New Orleans Museum of Art curator Vanessa Schmidt about the new catalog, The Orleans Collection, accompanying the exhibit currently on view at NOMA until January 27th. We'll also hear from Sally Asher about her very charming book, The Mermaids of New Orleans. Vanessa Schmidt is the Senior Research Curator of European Art at the New Orleans Museum of Art. She's the author of a beautiful new catalog, The Orleans Collection, which accompanies the exhibit now on view at NOMA of the art collected by Philippe II, the Duke d'Orléans. It is a gorgeous coffee table book with fascinating essays by 8 authorities on various areas represented in the collection. It is such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, the first thing you notice about this book is its beauty. It fairly glows at you, you know, when you look at the cover. So I'd like you to talk about the great effort that went into putting together the exhibit and a publication like this. It was really an international effort. And this is an international volume, really.
Really, every part of this exhibition and its catalog has drawn upon all parts of our museum, of NOMA, all departments. To put together an international project like this, we have French colleagues, colleagues from London, and also other U.S. Scholars who have contributed to the catalog, but that also to gather these works of art, the catalog is, of course, the catalog of the exhibition now on view, and the exhibition brings together 38 masterpieces from 25 lending institutions. And the catalog was conceived as not only, of course, to complement the installation, though I should say the installation is in many ways its own conceit. It does complement the catalog. But the catalog was designed, you mentioned the 8 contributors. We have 10 essays that unpack our story from a range of lenses and perspectives. And the idea is that this range of essays gives or offers not just a comprehensive view, but a starting point for further research.
Well, in some ways, it seems to me like it's as if you were putting together a vanished museum. You knew what the works were. Even knew how they were arranged. And you recount that in great detail. Like there's this wonderful remark that an exhibit was arranged as if this penitent young man were looking at all these nudes around a hallway. And it's very witty and humorous, and it makes you like the collector. But it also makes you imagine what this was like at one point, what a magnificent collection it was.
Exactly, a kind of virtual collection. And indeed, it's interesting to me that you have also clued in what so many, I think, visitors and others have really connected with this show, is an idea of this reuniting. There's something about that sparks the imagination and just sparks the interest. One of the things we say in our tours is that the objects on view right now at NOMA, the last time they were together is when the collection was sold in the 1790s in London, so 220 plus years ago. And yes, you said we know where objects are and the way they were arranged. And you mentioned the nudes, that actually the Duke had quite a naughty side. He loved his nudes. And we have some gorgeous ones on view as well. But an important aspect of the catalog is, in fact, the tracing of those paintings. Mm-hmm. We trace them. Julia Armstrong Totten, I have to give her an individual shout out for her incredible research. So that's another element. And as you leaf through the catalog, it's designed so that every illustration in the catalog has a number that makes reference to our appendix that traces the paintings. So in fact, what is brought together pictorially through the volume is not only the important record of the exhibition we've brought together, but that all of the highlights from the collection and the full view of the collection is given even just through the illustrations, let alone the texts we've talked about.
But it also makes you curious about the collector who brought all these things together, who was quite a character. So tell us a little bit about him.
Indeed. I'll take a minute to review our history for our listeners.
Great.
So Philippe II, Duke of Orléans, served as regent of France, meaning he served in lieu or served as surrogate ruler between 1715 and 1723. And hence New Orleans, which was founded in 1718, that makes him our namesake. And he served as regent because Louis XIV, the great Sun King, absolutist monarch, who had had an incredible reign of over 65 years, dies in 1715. And the two heirs to the throne had recently died 2 years prior. And so the heir to the throne is Louis XV, who is 5 years old. So the regent, or the Duke of Orléans, we refer to him as both our duke or the regent. And so he ruled France in this 8-year regency period. He had a wide-ranging reputation, as you say, quite a character. He is known to history for two kind of main aspects of his character. One is as a great patron of the arts, not just painting, but also opera, music, theater, and furniture, in fact. But the other side of his character is that he really was known as quite a, shall we say, roué. He knew how to have a good time.
Well, and I wonder if you would read that little verse by Voltaire.
Oh,
because
oh,
I thought
yeah.
that was so. I've
oh,
got it marked.
Isn't that yes? You thought
it's
of it.
It's so
well,
charming.
Okay. And actually, we quote it in the exhibition. And I should say where this is quoted. This is in the biography that is this wonderful biography written by Alexandre Dupilet, who is a historian in mm-hmm. Paris. And he wrote the 2012 reevaluation of the Duke, the really indispensable biography. So one of the achievements of the catalog is the bite-sized 4,000-word biography that is a reassessment of the Duke and in English. Mm-hmm. And the quote you'd like me to read, in fact, is, "Now mark the regency, licentious time, auspicious era. Lust was then in prime, as folly, tinkling loud her bells in hand, with lightsome stepped, tripped over Gallia's land, where to devotion not a soul was prone, and every act, save penitence, was known. The regent, from his Palais Royal's hall, gives signal of voluptuousness to all."
That just makes you happy to read it, doesn't it?
I appreciate that you picked up that comment. It is a wonderful quote.
So tell us about some of the artists in this exhibition. Some of them are just household names.
Absolutely, they are household names. Well, I would say, let's see, we have a fabulous oil sketch by Peter Paul Rubens. What is so, I think, in many ways attractive about the work is it is what we call an oil sketch. So I mentioned that. Which means it has areas of finish and unfinish. It really is a virtuosic, quick painting with quick brushwork mm-hmm. and gestural painting. It's fresh in extraordinary condition. So that's Peter Paul Rubens. We have two glorious paintings by the artist Nicolas Poussin. He was considered the founder of French classicist painting of the 1600s. And we have two glorious paintings by him. We have also the work of Rembrandt
yes.
Van Rijn, which is serves as the crescendo to the exhibition. It's the last painting in the last room. Rembrandt painted about 24 landscapes. He explored the subject of landscape more in his drawings and etchings. But this, of those painted landscapes, is the most monumental and really glorious. And it's here from the National Gallery of Art in Washington.
Because when you design an exhibit like this, you speak of that as the climax of the exhibit, you are really designing an experience for the viewer. That's what you're after.
Absolutely. The experiential values of how you put together the design of installation is definitely paramount. I mean, and for this exhibition, we have grand, bold colors, just two colors that punctuate two main areas of the exhibition, and the visitor is drawn from room to room or through the galleries by pivotal artworks, or what we might call sight lines. And we have actually 8 exhibition sections. Some of them are mini sections. But for example, the first, you enter the exhibition with what we call the title wall. The title wall draws you from the great hall after you enter the museum, that wonderful hall, that central hall we have. And what is drawing you to the show is a large marble bust. It has an incredible presence, and it's a very dynamic sculpture in white marble. And so that is set against actually a patterned background, a wallpaper, which mimics an 18th century silk wallpaper. Mm-hmm. And so that already, even just from the first title wall, draws you into the exhibition.
You're there.
And yes, and that's how each kind of room or corner you turn focuses on works of art.
One of the things that fascinates me about all of this is that you know so much about this collection. This is a real tribute to the survival of art, the survival of paper. You know what I mean? All these records of sales, of advice, of the dispersal of the collection. Was there anything you couldn't track down? Is there anything that's still missing out there in the world?
Thank you. Yeah, let me say a little bit about what you say about how much exists. Yes, of course, this is why I'm an art historian. There's a shocking amount of wonderful historical material. We have things like the inventory of his death. He died in 1723, but the inventory is done 1724, a wonderful handwritten inventory, and as notaries often do, they went around a room from left to right. So when you say we know where things hung, that's because you can kind of figure it out, and particularly once you figure out what rooms they're in and the kind of rhythm in which an inventory is written. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of documentation concerning the dispersal. Our story arc goes, just because our listeners haven't heard it, is that we focus in the exhibition on Philippe II, Duke of Orléans, and his collection, which he amassed and during the Regency between 1715 and 1723. The collection on view and displayed at his Palais Royal in the center of Paris remained in the Palais Royal with his descendants. Throughout the course of the 18th century, the collection becomes actually increasingly, its reputation really increases only over time. And you have more and more of a culture of tourists and travelers as the 18th century progresses. We get to the 1780s, and the Duke's great-grandson, Louis-Philippe Joseph, he decides to sell the collection. He has debts to pay, and on the eve of the French Revolution, he has actually political motivations. He aims to back the French Revolution. It's a rather complex story, but the end result is that the collection is extraordinary. Over 500 paintings are sold in London. So they go from Paris to London, and these sales are very well recorded. They occur in the later 1790s in 2 different groups of paintings. And we have wonderful documentation on that. What doesn't exist, you say? Well, first of all, the attrition rate of paintings. We have traced in the appendix of the catalog, we have traced 183 paintings to public collections. If you think that the first inventory was of 537 paintings, that's an attrition rate of a generous maybe 50%, given that, fascinatingly enough, every couple of years, Orléans pictures, meaning pictures that were from the Orléans collection, come up at auction. And so over the past 50 years, we can estimate there are 40 or 50 paintings out there in private hands. So certainly just the attrition rate and the loss of paintings is part of the story. And there are one of the things that I would say is an interesting aspect of the catalog is how other people in the period tell us about the Duke and his collection. But we have nothing written by him.
Oh.
Yeah. So certainly I wouldn't say any part of the catalog at all is guesswork, but that our understanding of the Duke is always from other sources, never his written hand.
How fascinating. Oh, this must be the most fun thing you've ever undertaken. You have that look.
All I can say is, of course, this is an incredible privilege that our institution has mounted such an ambitious project for the tricentennial. as an absolutely fitting celebration of a city I have come to simply adore.
Well, it's a gift, so we thank you for it.
Thank you, Susan.
Oh, we've been talking with Vanessa Schmid, the Senior Research Curator of European Art at the New Orleans Museum of Art and author of the catalog, The Orleans Collection. The exhibit is on view until January 27th, and the book is available at the NoMA Museum Shop. Vanessa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
À Copenhague, la sirène désespère les marins séduits. Elle raille, sereine, les cœurs éconduits. Son âme est celle d'une reine puritaine. Elle lance un regard de flamme pour les fantasmes de leur nuit. Aux amoureux, elle sursure l'ennui, car son visage...
Sally Asher is the author of Stories from the St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans and Hope in New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names. And she's working on a history of Crescent City Prohibition. Today, we're talking about her lighter side, the part of her life that comes from being, a former Big Easy roller girl, the current co-captain of the crew of Les Jurettes, which celebrates Princess Leia of Star Wars. Now, together with artist Melissa Van Diver, Sally's created The Mermaids of New Orleans, a fanciful reimagination of our city with some real inhabitants. Sally Asher, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
I never know what you're going to do next. It's so interesting. So you're working on Prohibition, and you take this little detour.
Yes, I one day was inspired by my coworker, Taryn. I started thinking about how everyone around the world, cultures, traditions, people are different in the cities that they live in. And then for some reason, I thought, well, that's got to be the true for mermaids as well. You know, all mermaids across the country and across the world can't be alike. And the mermaids of New Orleans have to definitely be different.
So you take us deep beneath the river to the Mermaid City, which does resemble New Orleans in a few ways.
Yes, I didn't want it to have this kind of fairy-like mermaid city, sparkles and jewels and diamonds. I really wanted it to be found objects. I wanted the mermaids to influence New Orleans and New Orleans to influence the mermaids. So they live in trident houses, which are like shotgun houses, except you can throw a trident from one end of the room to the other without hitting. And it's all done found objects. So you'll find some local brands, you know, there's some old signs reused, Louis Prima's brothers, Leon Prima's burlesque. There's a sign that's holding a house up, and there's shutters and doors and just various objects, some muses' shoes stuck up as planters. It's just pieced together, it's things that you would find.
That's the New Orleans way to,
yes.
to use everything and transform it. It's so interesting to me that people who think seriously about the city in a scholarly way, as you do. And I think of people like Moira Crone. And you get to this point where you imagine the city as a drowned city or an island city or an underwater city. You know what I mean? It's like drenched maybe, but not drowned, I guess.
I try not to think about that, to be honest. I get worried when I read the reports, New Orleans is not going to be here in 100 years. I tend to ignore those reports and just focus
yes.
On the here and now. And but if we do, then we have a lovely city to go to underneath the Mississippi River.
When we'll have great tales, too.
Yes.
I mean,
that's a good pun.
This is a coping mechanism, you know. That's what this book is. It's a fabulous coping mechanism. Now, you're an artist yourself. You're a wonderful photographer. So what was it like for you to work with an artist like Melissa Van Diver and develop a joint vision for this story?
It was actually a dream, because I had never worked with another artist before, uh-huh. and I was very nervous because I'm extremely opinionated and very, very detail-oriented. But I also want the artist to be able to feel free to express themselves and insert their opinions. And it seems to be either they're too afraid to do that, or they do it so much so that it kind of moves off the vision. And Melissa was fantastic. There are a lot of local hidden icons, what I call Easter eggs, in the book. They're all based on real people. Every single mermaid is influenced by a friend or somebody that I admire. And I must have submitted hundreds and hundreds of individual folders, Dropbox folders for her, of pictures to go through. For example, in the Trident houses, found objects. And I would say for Jetsam Square, you know, I want a gold mermaid statue, and I want a tip jar, and I want a crawfish putting, you know, the tip
yes.
jar in, and this person going by here, and we're going to have a James Booker alligator and a Dr. John Nutria playing the piano. And she would take everything that I gave her and kind of absorb it and still manage to make it her own and sometimes put unique perspectives on things that I hadn't even thought of. So she took everything I said and she translated it and still managed to put her own mark on it, which was fabulous.
And the color palette is so extraordinary. It's so bright and beautiful and lively. It's really great.
Thank you. Yeah, we wanted it bright. I didn't want it to be realistic, and we didn't want it to be cartoony.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to find a really nice balance between. And we went through a few drafts together, and she did what she calls her audition painting. Her final audition painting was of Big Frida as a mermaid.
Oh, love that.
And
that.
That's when I said, yes, we're going to work out very well together.
Well, this is a book that celebrates women in so many ways, and you've explored that in your private life and your professional life. So talk a little bit about what these icons of femininity mean to you. What do mermaids have to say to us?
We didn't want the whole fantasy Barbie doll,
yeah.
you know, tiny waist, long flowing blonde hair, because I wanted them to represent my friends, and I wanted them to represent women of New Orleans. And so there's just a whole different variety of ethnicity and body types. That was always a goal of mine. But I didn't realize how important it was until the book was actually at the printers. And I started looking around for fabric. So my mom would make me some tablecloths, little mermaid tablecloths at our book signings when we dress up as mermaids and we sign the books. We wanted it to be fanciful and fun. And I must have gone through 50 or 60 before I found any fabric that had a mermaid of color on it, which was very, very surprising. And then when I really started, you know, digging, realizing mermaids of color aren't represented at all.
Mm-hmm.
And why would they not be? I can just imagine all little girls wanting to see themselves in mermaids.
Mm-hmm.
And that became very relevant and very significant when I realized how little that is. When I've done different book signings, for example, we did one at the aquarium and we did a reading at Hubble Library. And to see these little girls flip through the pages and see a mermaid that looks like themselves is really powerful and it's really important. The funny thing is, though, we were both very strong on having, you know, different body types, different hair lengths. For example, if I was a mermaid, I would cut my hair very, very short because there is no way I would want hair flying all around my face while I swam. But the cover, one of the individuals on the cover is my friend daughter's Logan, who I told her that she would have a purple afro, and she was good with that. And the other one is my friend Veronica Russell, who passed away a few years ago, and she would corset to a 19-inch waist.
Yes.
And so I told Melissa, the artist, you know, Veronica has to be in corsets, and she has to have this very small waist. So we do the cover of the book, and the editor comes back to me and says, I thought you were working on realistic body types. And I said, I am. She corsets to a 19-inch waist.
This is your great homage to her.
That was actually, she would probably be very upset. That was actually the one thing that the editor changed, is I had to thicken her waist a little bit on the cover.
Oh.
But in reality, she had a very thin waist, and it's shown in the pages on her special page in the book.
And that is a very special page.
Yeah,
that's
so
really a labor of love.
It was ironic that we spent so much time touting that we wanted these mermaids to be realistic. And then I put on the cover probably one of the most unrealistic body types of a friend I know.
Well, there's a lot of love in this book.
I'm hoping that it works on three levels. And the first level is you just read it and you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second level is if you're a New Orleanian or you love the city and you know the city, that you can read it and really get the inside jokes. And then the third level is my friends who can look and, you know, see their friends and their coworkers. And you might recognize one person on the fleet car, Susan Larson, reading a book.
We might
as
recognize
a mermaid.
George Ingmyr, not a mermaid, in the Mardi Gras crowd. So
I had some friends who did the ultimate sacrifice where I said, look, I can put you in the book. but you can or cannot be, you know, with your husband or your boyfriend, because they go on land one day a year. All mermaids go on land, according to mermaid lore, one day a year. And New Orleans mermaids, of course, choose Mardi Gras Day.
Of course.
So I said, well, that's where my male friends will be represented. And my friends had a choice to make. I can be a mermaid or I can be with my husband on land. And a lot ditched their husbands in order to be a mermaid. But some did make the ultimate sacrifice, and they're represented on land during Mardi Gras Day, as well as the Muffaladas, the Sirens, yes, the 610 Stompers, St. Augustine's Band, Mardi Gras Indians, the Baby Dolls, Rex, Zulu, just about everything you can imagine on Mardi Gras Day.
All the most joyful things about New Orleans.
And my dogs made it into the book as well.
As did
a few choice other dogs. But of course, they had to be on land for Mardi Gras Day.
Of course. So now it's back to Prohibition. That sounds kind of deadly.
No, it's amazing. I've been writing it for almost 3 years now. And my problem is I keep finding all these incredibly interesting stories that have never been told before. So I keep digging deeper and deeper, and my poor editor is like, just finish it. But I'm just a couple chapters away from being done.
Oh,
and I'm so excited. And then on to the next mermaid. I would like to do a series. The next book I'm working on is The Mermaids of Seattle, that can represent the different cities and the cultures and ethnicities all around the country.
That's a great project, Sally, but all your projects are. We've been talking with writer Sally Asher, who with illustrator Melissa Van Diver is the creator of The Mermaids of New Orleans. You'll never look at the Crescent City the same way again. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, writer Sally Asher and artist Melissa Van Diver sign Mermaids of New Orleans Sunday, December 16th from 12:30 to 1:30 at the New Orleans Children's Museum, 420 Julia Street. Shayna Monet and Athena Dixon appear at Pastries and Poets Sunday, December 16th from 2 to 4 at the Dragonfly Poetry and Performance Ritual Space. Gina Ferrara hosts a tricentennial reading of poems about or written in New Orleans, Tuesday, December 18th from 5:30 to 7:30 at Ladder Library. Visiting writer and poet Laura Goldstein presents a one-day writing workshop, Thursday, December 20th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Dragonfly. That's at 3921 St. Claude Avenue. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Frick Collection Center for the History of Collecting will host a two-day symposium, January 11th through 12th, in conjunction with the Orleans Collection, an exhibit dedicated to the collecting and collection of Philippe II, Duke of Orleans, who lived from 1624 to 1723. That's on view at NOMA through January 27th. For the complete schedule and to register for the symposium, check out noma.org. In Baton Rouge, Chef John Foles signs his many cookbooks, Friday, December 21st at 5 at Barnes & Noble City Place. Johnny Anderson signs Heal Before You Deal, Saturday, December 22nd at 11 a.m. at Barnes & Noble, Perkins Row. Johnny Anderson signs Heal Before You Deal, Saturday, December 21st at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble, Perkins Row. Christy Guillory Reed signs her children's book, Harper Counts Her Blessings, Saturday, December 22nd at 5:30 at Barnes & Noble, Perkins Row. And Jeffrey Marks signs Walking with Tigers, Sunday, December 23rd at noon at Barnes & Noble on Perkins Row. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.
The